Before we start the podcast, I wonder if you've discovered the Letter from Loring Park, our weekly email bundle of goodness that lands in your inbox every Saturday morning. We highlight what we're airing and writing and reading, along with news of upcoming events and opportunities to be part of our wider conversations. To subscribe now, go to onbeing.org.
On Being is brought to you by the John Templeton Foundation. The Templeton Foundation supports academic research and civil dialogue on the deepest, most perplexing questions facing humankind. Who are we? Why are we here? And where are we going? To learn more, please visit templeton.org. The Templeton Foundation. Stay curious.
The subject of my work, Myra Kalman says, is the normal daily things that people fall in love with. She is a visual storyteller, and to be in conversation with her is a little like wandering into one of the cartoons you might see in The New Yorker and which she might have drawn. Millions of us have been prompted to smile and think by Myra Kalman's work in a museum or the recent illustrated revision of Strunk and White's Elements of Style or a New York Times blog or her lovely books and her drawings about dogs. Her words and pictures bring life's whimsy and quirkiness into relief right alongside life's intrinsic seriousness, its most curious truths.
The way that we move through space is really interesting to me, and I am conscious of the fact that we are moving and dancing in our way all day long. It's funny because Nietzsche said that a day that doesn't have dance in it is a lost day, which you wouldn't expect from somebody like Nietzsche, who was crazy.
And intense.
And intense, and had such a giant mustache, as I write about. But the fact is that we really are all moving and dancing all day long. And the older you get, the more dangerous it is. And you can trip. I tripped on the sidewalk and broke my arm. And I thought, well, how did this happen? This is absurd. So my heart goes out to everybody. That's it. My heart goes out to everybody.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Myra Kalman is the author and illustrator of over 20 books for adults and children. She's well known for her New York Times blogs that have become books like The Principles of Uncertainty. She grew up in the Bronx and now lives in Manhattan. You were born in Israel, sounds like, and you came to New York at the age of 4. How would you describe the spiritual background of your childhood, however you would define that?
It's interesting because really all of my work goes back to my childhood, as many people can say about their lives, and even the childhood of my mother in Belarus. So I'm constantly relating to and living in the family, the stories, the light, the air, the sea, the cafes, the fluttering awnings, all of that resonates so strongly for me in all of my work, and I'm painting and writing about it all the time, and even more so now.
You know, I think that's right, that so much of who we become and even like the questions we follow all our lives go back to that, but I feel like you're more in touch with that than a lot of people.
It's relentless, whether I like it or not.
Right. And relentlessly it's also my, in touch, yeah.
Relentlessly in touch with something wonderful, which I guess is a good thing. But I'm. It's so profound and so wonderful and so sad and so everything that I can't stop it, and it just gets richer and richer.
It was your mother's family that came from Belarus, is that right?
Or both my father both and my mother. They just came in different times and they met in Israel, but they both came from little villages not far from each other, actually, which I went to visit a few years ago.
So, I don't know how you describe yourself. I think when people call you a visual storyteller, that feels like a good pointer to me. Where do you trace the roots of that in your early life?
It's really such a lovely and erratic tracing. I really thought that I was going to be a writer, and everything was born of that. I read Pippi Longstocking when I was 8 years old, and I thought, that's it, I'm going to be a writer.
Right.
So, you know, I can do that. And then my writing became so heavy and laden with angst and misery and confusion and so tedious that I thought, this can't be the right thing to do. I want to do something fun and easy, and that might be drawing. So my sister was an artist, and I thought, well, that looks like a tremendous amount of fun, even though, of course, the artists were very miserable. But I thought, I can do that. Mm. So my writing informs my painting, and the painting informs the writing, and they really are connected in very intimate and vital ways.
It's so interesting that you describe your early writing as angst-ridden, because that's so different from, I think, the words someone might use to describe your books, your illustrated writing now, right? I mean,
right. Well, the angst is invisible. I mean, I worry and suffer tremendously. I must assure everybody, but I just somehow am able to eliminate that and come across as a very optimistic and joyous person, which in fact I also am. So I'm completely confused.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I mean, I would say I don't know if I would talk about angst, but I mean, definitely, and we're going to talk about this. You touch on very serious subjects, like very deep, serious parts of being alive, but somehow hold it in this context of pictures and words, which are also whimsical and playful. I mean, that's kind of what you're saying. I mean, I would say that one of the things that really struck me as kind of a theme, a thread, as I kind of looked at your body of work, is that, in fact, you actually hold together contradictory experiences and impulses that in fact are the very vitality of life, but that we often treat as opposites, right? So angst,
yes,
and whimsy.
Right.
But also I would say another one, just kind of thinking about how I've seen you talk about how you spend your days, how you organize your life and your art, you know, on the one hand, what at least looks on the outside, like very much like just this great spontaneity. I mean, this ability and this to follow your nose kind of and then work with that. But also you adore ritual, and those two things work together for you.
Yeah, it's taken me these many years to understand that a human being can encompass very contradictory ideas and feelings at the exact same time. Mm-hmm. They're not separate. They don't even follow each other so much. They just live in you. And for me, to clarify what I love, to do what's amazing, to understand my confusion or my sorrow, and to still continue to, I mean, the thing about it is that you persevere, you know, and so I do follow my nose, and I do have many rituals that I love following, and I love breaking the rituals. So I'm not a prisoner of the construct of my day. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, I'm spending too much time wandering around when I actually have work to do. But I always say this must be the work that I need to do right now before I do that other work. And really, I think the more that I work and the more that I see what my life is, the more simple it becomes and very elemental. I mean, it's really it's very boring, actually. Probably if most people had to live it, they would go, oh, that's it.
Well, I mean, let's talk about, you know, how you start your days. And so it's interesting to me. I think you don't do this anymore, but for a while you used to read the obituaries at the beginning of the day.
That's my religion. That I won't break.
Do you still do that?
Every single day. That's the first thing. Coffee and the obits.
Okay, how did that start? When did that start?
It started when I was born. I don't know. It started so many years ago because, of course, the essence of people's lives, what happens to them in several hundred words and a few pictures, is really an extraordinary way to start the day, to see what the range of human endeavor is, from what seems to be trivial to monumental. But none of those are ever trivial, and monumental sometimes is even less interesting. But that there is a great sense of hope in these obituaries, because people have done amazing things.
Yeah, I was somewhere, I'm just trying to, in the Principles of Uncertainty, I think you have this place where you say maybe that you read the obituaries at the beginning of every day. Maybe it is a way of trying to figure out before the day begins what is important. And I'm curious about all the little things that make up a life. Can you, do you have some favorite obituaries or obituaries that come to mind that have struck you recently? Like, just as an example.
Well, recently I just read the obit of a Hungarian woman whose family escaped the Holocaust, and she ended up marrying a cousin of Nehru and lived in India and had this extraordinary life. So I love that one. What else was recently amazing? I mean, whenever I think of the best obituaries, I think of the man who invented the bundt pen, who I have in my book. But,
right. There's another one, Megan Boyd in Scotland.
Yes, Megan Boyd, who created the flies for fly fishing her entire life and lived in a little village. Yeah, so she had a fantastic obit and a beautiful photo that I did a painting of.
But it was also very kind of intricate, long work, right? I mean, it was... It sounds so romantic when we say it like that, and in fact, history-making in a way, but it was also the care and the detail.
Well, you know, that's what, once again, the perseverance of work, the insistence that you keep doing it and you continue no matter what, and through bad periods and better periods. So there she was sitting at her bench 16 hours a day, and when she was invited to Buckingham Palace, she said she couldn't go because she had to go to a dance in the village.
Right, right.
And I thought, now, this woman's a genius.
Right, so. Yeah. So you read the obituaries, and then do you walk every day, walk in the park?
Yes. Well, I meet a friend, and it's now it's 20 years that we have walked 3 times a day in Central Park. Mm. The other days I try to walk, but I'm not as motivated without her. She's a great companion, and then we have a cup of coffee. She's a doctor. She goes and saves lives, and I don't know what I do. I save myself, or I help other people live. Mm. And it's in between, after we finish the coffee, I take the bus down Fifth Avenue, and then I'm probably the happiest person, you know, on the bus. And then I say in New York, and then I say in the United States, and then I say in the world. It's really extraordinary. I mean, when we're in the park and there aren't that many people there and we go all year round, we think, where is everybody? How could they be so stupid as not to understand what they have here for them, for themselves? Mm. But there you go.
Here's another line of yours I love. We see trees. What more do we need?
That's really true. I mean, everybody, it's really hard to be sad. And, of course, I'm always looking at the things that make somebody less sad, a.k.a. happy, which is not a.k.a. at all. And so walking and looking at trees really is one of the glories of the world. And, you know, we say rejoice when we see these things. We say that when we see people walking and going about their business. But something about trees, of course, they're very hard to paint, by the way, but I'm happy to try.
Hmm. Well, and again, I don't know, I guess I'm speaking for myself, but I think I've also heard plenty of people talking about, you know, really important moments of their lives that had to do with pondering a tree. And I mean, you know, it amazes me that trees are just, they're so perfect and gorgeous and amazing. And they just are.
They just are.
And they are, whether we're looking at them or painting them or admiring them or not, or whatever the weather is. But I don't think most people, you know, even as I say that about myself, I don't put myself into that position to be adoring them and letting them make me be happy and get some perspective on my life, right? But you put yourself out there to do that.
Well, you know, there's always, you can always start.
That's true.
You can look, and you know, leaves grow on trees and birds sit in trees and birds sing, and it's a whole beautiful package.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, I'm with the visual storyteller, Myra Kalman.
We touched on this a little bit when we touched on angst, the beginning of our conversation, but another, I would say, just juxtaposition that you hold together, and you hold together as vitality, is kind of life's intrinsic whimsy and quirkiness, and also life's intrinsic sorrow.
Yeah, and actually, I wouldn't attribute the whimsy and the quirkiness. I would say it's completely inexplicable, random, confusing, fragile, fragment. You know, that I impose in my way a sense of humor about it all, of course, but I don't know what the world offers. The world offers so many different things that are really incomprehensible.
Yeah.
So the take that you have on it, of course, is what happens with the rest of the day.
Right, right. You know, there's this one, I didn't see this anywhere else. Obviously, I haven't read every single word, but there's one place, and I believe it's in the Principles of Uncertainty, where you say that your mother did not marry the man she loved, but instead your father. Is that right?
That's true. Yeah, it's sad. I think about that a lot because I was so close to her. My father was away a lot. He traveled half the year, not consecutively, but he was really gone a lot. And the women were left, as I say, to their own devices, which in our case was kind of wonderful because he was a rather, in the old form, a patriarchal man who ruled as the patriarchs did in those generations.
Yeah.
So when he was away, we really flourished in a way and found out what it was like to be a woman, to be a young girl, to be a woman, and to just be who you are. And so, I of course, there are so many sad things about that, but I think that the strength of the women in my family was so formidable, even in their sorrow or suffering, or that something registered in me that said, you can observe really unhappy relationships and still find a good one. I found a fantastic relationship with my husband. So I think probably one of the things I learned was what not to do.
Mm.
So it's a good lesson. You can watch closely and say, aha, this is not going to happen to me.
Yeah, well, that's good. It can work both ways. Did you know when you were growing up, was this a story your mother told about herself, about this man?
No, she never... You know, my mother never said anything about anything negative. Mm-hmm. And it was really from other people in the family and family lore that, you know, you just absorb through the years that she was madly in love with somebody else. And it just, the fates did not allow it.
Yeah. And again, for all the beauty and playfulness and, you know, what is it you say? You know, the subject of my work continues to be the normal daily things that people fall in love with. And then you also are very open about thinking a lot about death and fearing death. Has that always been true?
Who does? You know, Krista, who doesn't? I'm always amazed if somebody says, you think about death so much. And I said, what are you thinking about? I mean, I can't imagine, but...
I thought about it when I was... when I was getting ready for this, I don't know that I do think about it. I mean, I have all kinds of fears. It's not that I don't have fears and anxieties, but not in the way it comes out in your work.
Yeah, I think you're lucky.
okay.
I don't. You know what? I think that it has, of course, it has a lot to do with the family history, which is especially from my father, who left Belarus and his family didn't leave. And they thought, well, you know, what could go wrong? And they were all killed. What went wrong. Mm-hmm. So I was brought up on the idea that everything could disappear. And this is nothing, obviously, many, many people have this, that all could be lost in a nanosecond, that you're never safe, and that tragedy and literal killing is part of the possibility.
Yeah.
And especially going to Israel and having the sense of, again, being warriors in the defense of a nation that's being attacked in historically. Of course, things have changed so dramatically now, it's intensely complicated to even discuss it. But from the point of view of people who were escaping the Holocaust and coming to Israel, the sense of, you know, we cannot let this happen again. So that somehow enters into this, somehow it very clearly enters into the persona of, well, wow. My family was killed.
Well, it's in your DNA is what we're learning, right? It's literally in your body. Yeah.
Right. Yep.
Right. And then your husband died at 49, which is so young, although you had such a good long time together, right?
We had an extraordinary life.
Three decades?
And I think And I think how fortunate, how completely amazing that we met in summer flunk-out class at NYU in the late 60s when everybody was doing everything except going to school.
Yeah.
And we had such an amazing time and had a family, had two children and worked together and really were each other's muses and support in every way. So I am profoundly grateful to have had that relationship and to have somehow been with a man who was very courageous and taught me how to be brave.
Mm. Because he was brave? Did he teach you by being that?
He was, you know, I always used to say he was fearless. Mm. He didn't ever think anything would stop him, ever. You know, he did. It just wasn't in his vocabulary. Mm. So when you live with somebody like that, it's very interesting to say you have an idea, and then if you don't act on it, well, why wouldn't you? It sounds very simple because, of course, some things don't work out, and it's not always such a straight line, but you live in a you're breathing a different kind of air.
Mm. There's a passage where you write and illustrate about, you know, I mean, you start with Gershwin dying at the age of 38 of a brain tumor. You say, he's buried in the same cemetery as my husband. My husband died at the age of 49. I could collapse thinking about that. But I don't want to talk about that now. I want to say that I love that George is nearby under a leafy tree, and Ira Gershwin too.
We're going to visit him next week, and really the high point is, we can say, I like visiting Tibor, but the high point is going to the Gershwins. No, I also the Barasinis are nearby, and I always think of a beautiful box of chocolates and how they should have a chocolate store there in the cemetery, because it's actually very uplifting to go to a cemetery, and it's a beautiful place, and so
yes,
somehow
is.
Things fall into place in a nice way.
Mm.
And it's good to visit him.
Mm. When did he die now? How long has that
been? It's 18 years, a few days ago.
Oh, okay. It was also interesting to me. I mean, you're beloved and known also for your Max Stravinsky, the poet dog, and your writings about dogs and your books about dogs, also for children, but also writing for adults, that you actually got your first dog, Pete, when your husband Tibor was dying from cancer. So there was the connection to that.
It was really profound. And of course, I was terrified of dogs before that and would never entertain getting one. But we decided that for the sake of the children, it was really incredible to have a dog who would be a great mood elevator. And I just didn't realize that I was probably the recipient of the most the most mood elevation from Pete.
You wrote in Beloved Dog, I thought this was wonderful. I'm sure many people who love dogs will resonate with this. They are constant reminders that life reveals the best of itself when we live fully in the moment and extend our unconditional love. And it is very true that the most tender, uncomplicated, most generous part of our being blossoms without any effort when it comes to the love of a dog.
That's true. My children have something to say about that.
What do they say? So,
well, they want to know who I love more, of course, you know, and they're not such children anymore. But I think that when they were younger, there was a little bit of a, so who do you really love over here? But because of the simplicity of it, because of the, that we can do that really easily. And
the love relationship with our children is complicated. Because
they can speak.
They are complicated. They can speak.
That's a big problem right away.
So. But I also love how you you name dogs as natural comedians.
Yes, of course. They're very funny. I mean, that's, of course, when I started looking at them, you know, when you're walking down the street. They're heroic and they're comic at the same time, which I guess is my favorite way of looking at things.
You can listen again and share this conversation with Myra Kelman through our website, onbeing.org. I'm Krista Tippett. On Being continues in a moment.
Support for On Being with Krista Tippett comes from the Fetzer Institute, helping build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Fetzer envisions a world that embraces love as a guiding principle and animating force for our lives, a powerful love that helps us live in sacred relationship with ourselves, others, and the natural world. Learn more by visiting Fetzer.org.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, I'm with the beloved visual storyteller Myra Kalman. She is well known for her books for children and adults, her love of dogs, her New Yorker covers. Her New York Times illustrated blogs become books with titles like The Principles of Uncertainty. Myra Kalman's words and her pictures bring life's intrinsic quirkiness and whimsy into relief, right alongside life's intrinsic seriousness.
I feel like you, I think what people love in your work also is that you're a real connoisseur of the art of laughing at oneself and also making other people laugh. And I think that must be a very joyful thing to be able to do.
It is, and I probably understood that when I was quite young. Mm. And maybe that was one of the things that I decided I needed to have in the face of whatever craziness was going on in my family, that having a sense of humor. I think also maybe coming from another country and just observing and having a sense of pleasure and joy in learning a new language and mm-hmm. watching people. And of course, in my family, everybody had a great sense of humor. So it wasn't as if I invented it in my family. That was the language of conversation, that you told funny stories.
Hmm. Really?
Yeah, especially from people, you know, who come from the Russian, you know, the tragic Russian writers. But as we say always, hand in hand with that,
right,
was a stupendous sense of humor and a sharp wit.
Do you have a meditation practice?
I have a limping.
I know that's kind of a personal question, but I've seen you.
No, it's fine. Yeah, the good news is that there's nothing personal about it. I was hired by a wonderful editor, Barry Boyce, at Mindful Magazine to meditate and to do a column about meditation. So I always say I was paid to meditate, which I think is not a bad way to encourage somebody to do it.
That's right.
And I went on a few very short silent retreats, a few days, and you know, I was taught the practice of meditation. And then I wasn't flippant about it. I really enjoyed it, and I really understood the value of being able to calm your soul and steady your anxieties, especially in the middle of the night. I'm immensely grateful that I have this practice, which I don't do regularly at all, you know, on the bus or walking here or waiting online or something like that, or in the middle of the night. So I think that it's non-spiritual and it's non-religious, which is really important for me because I don't like any religious dogma at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I value the sense that it's humanistic.
Right. Well, and actually, I feel it's something you both portray in your work and model is honoring, I would say, meditative spaces or even contemplative spaces in the everyday, but also in public life, like parks or museums, or, you know, I think of libraries in this way as well.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think about it that way?
I absolutely think that a museum is one of the deepest places of meditation that there could be.
Yeah.
Maybe even more than a library, because you're looking. In a museum, you're not reading. I mean, you're reading a little bit, but you're basically just wandering and looking. And once again, the function of the brain, what happens to the brain is very different than, I don't know, than being in a supermarket, even though I love being a supermarket. So wait a minute. I love supermarkets. I love to look at all the packaging. To me, that's a little bit like a museum, but that's a digression.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we have the opportunity to understand silence around us and really looking all the time. There's always the opportunity, and there's never a lack of things to look at, and you know, there's never a lack of time not to talk.
Yeah, and I mean, museums are just among the very few silent places in culture, right? Where that is part of the element of the experience. It's actually very unusual. I guess when we go to a concert, I mean, I guess there are places mm-hmm. we listen, but there's not.
Right. It's different than looking at something and not talking and absorbing it in that way. If you approach it the right way and don't trudge through too many things that you can't stand,
mm-hmm.
It really gives you a sense of inspiration and clarity in your life.
I spoke to Anne Hamilton a couple of years ago, and you know, she used this phrase, alone together. I think that's the other thing. Mm-hmm. It's different from being at a concert or a performance where you're having a communal, a collective experience, because you're kind of, it's both in a museum, right? You're having a very personal meander. And what you're paying attention to, you're choosing, but and yet you are not alone.
And it's, you know, I spend Fridays at the Met for two reasons. One, because I have an exhibit at the Met with an installation with my son called, which is a recreation of my mother's closet. And it's in the American wing. And it's a wonderful, my mother only wore white, and she was very precise about her clothing and about her closet. And her closet really was a work of art in its way. So it's now at the Met, I'm happy to say.
You know, so your mother's closet, I mean, I guess even when you said that the supermarket for you is kind of like a museum, that you're looking at the packaging, and I think of also the way you talk about being in the park, and you also take great delight in clothing, hats, shoes, and not in the way we tend to think about those things in terms of fashion, but in terms of how interesting humans are, how interesting life is.
I'm so curious about so many things that I surprise myself by with my curiosity and my desire, my delight in seeing all of this stuff, because at a certain point you'd say, okay, enough already. But clearly it's never enough. And that, you know, it's a surprise. You just don't know what you're going to see.
Yeah.
And the fact that I can use that surprise in my work, the fact that I can not know what the painting that I have to do tomorrow will include for an assignment that I know what the assignment is, but I don't know what woman wearing what dress, walking what dog, if that's the case, or some person's playing the violin on the street, how they enter the work. And I think that the immediacy of my emotions is felt in the drawings.
I want to talk a little bit about the principles of uncertainty, which was to like continue on your the philosophical meditative side of you, which is also whimsical. It's interesting, you know, your mother comes in again, your mother's map of the world. Obviously, people who are just listening to us talk won't have that picture in front of them, but talk about what is there and why that is so important for you. That's an important touch point for you, that map.
I have to say that the map, for those listeners who are inclined, I've spoken of it so many times that it must be online. So if you go to Sarah Berman's map of the United States or something like that, you might find it. But when I was doing the next year's piece, the year that I did about American history and the pursuit of happiness for the New York Times after my year of introspection, they sent me to all kinds of places. And I asked many people to draw a map of the United States from memory. Just sit down and do it. And, you know, as I say, it's a complicated country with lots of different sections. And I don't think most people would get it 100% right. But my mother sat down and made an egg-shaped circle and Canada on top. So far, so good. But then she has California and Hawaii underneath Canada. She has, everything is completely topsy-turvy. She has Lenin, the village she came from, and Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. And she has a few random places that you are incomprehensible. And then through the center, she says, sorry, the rest unknown. Thank you. And I have a huge version of that on my wall to remind me that it's not about, I always say, it's not about getting it right. It's about just about getting it. Mm. And that's a big, big difference. If you have the freedom to use your imagination and to really express what you're thinking, you're going to come up with something a lot different than a correct version of the United States of America or anything.
Well, and it's also evocative right now in a way that you wouldn't have foreseen previously. But, you know, this fact that we, all of us all around in all of our differences, seem to be operating with different maps of the places that we know and the places that matter. I mean, that's a real phenomenon right now, these maps in our heads
Maps in our heads. And, you know, of course, then I think about the New Yorkistan map that I did with Rick Meyerowitz for The New Yorker after 9/11. And I think that with the conversations that people have about who are the tribes? Who do you belong to? Who do you belong with? Do you want to belong? Are there all kinds of new tribes now that we never understood or knew about? And really to find out, you know, who do you love and who do you want to be with? So you're forced to say, who do I relate to and who do I respect? Yeah. And that's a really big question. And who am I afraid of?
Yeah, you know, it would almost be a really fascinating civic activity for you to ask Americans to do their map, you know, to have your mother's map as the prototype mm-hmm. and say, create yeah. your own.
That's a good idea.
You know, it would be right now fascinating. The pursuit of happiness, because you said, also came out of, I mean, you went to all these places, right? You met with all kinds of different public service, and you went to the Capitol and farms and Mount Vernon and the White House.
Mm-hmm.
How
I went to the inauguration. I met right. Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I went to an army base. All the places that I wouldn't have access to as a normal person, the New York Times was able to send me to all of these places.
Yeah. How did that surprise you? How did that change you, that experience?
It changed me profoundly. I really knew very little about American history. And the more I traveled and the more I read and the more I met people, the more extraordinary the history of the United States. It was clear that this country is founded by some miracle chance of geniuses and that they were able to form an idea.
This was 2010, we should say, right? Or the book was published in 2010.
I did the traveling. I started 2008 with the inauguration of Obama.
Okay, yeah.
And, you know, went to Monticello and did a piece about Lincoln and did a piece about Jefferson and really had a chance, still superficial, obviously, to admire the United States so much more than I ever had, mm-hmm. with all the complexity, with all of the horrible parts which exist for every country. And I had a lot of fun thinking about all the good things that go on here.
Yeah, yeah. It's a beautiful celebration. And, you know, and I say that, and that can sound like a coffee table book, and it's not, right? It has that whimsy. It has that quirkiness. It has this constant interaction that is there in real life between play and what's interesting and fun and also hard and sad. There's a part, again, I meant to bring this, but, you know, it's okay because nobody who's listening to us is going to have the pictures in front of them either. You were at Fort Campbell, Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
the 101st Airborne Division. The way you wrote about those soldiers in that place, say a little bit about that, about what you saw. That was very moving to me.
The thing that happens when you meet people is that all generalizations fly out the window.
Yeah.
And you realize that people are leading very particular and very complex lives, and that you can't just make blanket statements. This group does this and that group does that. I mean, it's just immensely complicated, and every human being is a human being.
Yeah.
So people who you might think you have absolutely nothing in common with philosophically or just on a daily level, you find out that there's a tremendous amount of contact. And you know, I mean, it might be so obvious to say that, but I don't think that you can appreciate that until you actually go and live that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the more often that you can, it reduces a kind of arrogance or a kind of superiority, like, oh, I know the right way and you obviously don't, to clearly we have different ways of looking at things, but we really can have a conversation about it and find the common humanity. So that's what that taught me in a really wonderful way.
And they were getting, the 101st Airborne Division was getting ready to go to the battlefield, right? I think to Iraq or Afghanistan. And they were doing serious business. But you talk about, you know, how each one of them is so amazing. Each one of them breaks your heart. You know, just that the humanity. And then there's a picture of a piece of cherry pie. Do you remember this from the base?
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
You know, I'm always looking out for a good pie.
Yeah.
And a good painting of a pie. You know, it's those moments, of course, the smaller moments diffuse the bigger ones. And also they're really important. And so how do you sit together over a cherry pie?
Yeah.
And it wasn't that great, but, you know, it was good
the picture,
have.
It looked delicious in the picture.
Yeah, the picture was better than the...
Irresistible. I think you said something like, you know, this great solace is provided in the base by the piece of cherry pie.
Yes.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, I'm with the visual storyteller, Myra Kalman.
I feel like Lincoln is really important to you too, Abraham Lincoln.
I love Lincoln. I'm in love with Lincoln.
And how did that happen? Has that been a long time love?
And he doesn't know. I haven't said a word to him. I was asked by a library in Philadelphia to do a piece about Lincoln. So I went to their archive and I was looking at the work and started. And I have books of photographs of Lincoln. Of course, he is the iconic, the first president to be photographed, mm-hmm. and also just this extraordinarily beautiful humanitarian man of kindness and wit, a poet. And And the more I read about him, the more I understood that he did have a sense of humor and that he also was completely brilliant. And I thought I really had a big crush on him, and I was a little bit annoyed that he was with Mary Todd Lincoln. I wasn't even, and I wasn't registering the glitch of the time thing. I just was like, I really should be with him. And and it's, who doesn't fall in love with Lincoln? You spend 5 minutes reading about him or looking at his face, and it's really hard not to fall in love with this man.
I did notice that you noted that his stepmother loved him madly and let him be free to daydream. And I feel like you saw, your own mother and the way she let you be free to daydream in that.
That's true, the connection. But they make a lot of it in the history books that she really was somebody very unusual, and wasn't so keen on doing chores the way all the other boys were. And he was more interested in reading Shakespeare, which is extremely unusual. He only had a year of formal schooling. Mm. So for somebody to be kind and love you for that, that's critical.
Mm. And also I think we know this, right, that he's a good example of that. You said he has a sense of humor. I mean, he's kind of this glorious human being and also somebody who had great sadness and struggled with depression.
Yeah, I mean, Jefferson had, severe migraine attacks, which come from stress and, and sadness also. I mean, other things maybe. So, I mean, I can't imagine any human being that doesn't have attacks of depression. So clearly somebody who's living his life, losing his children, being in the war, the list could go on. How could he not be depressed? There'd have to be something wrong with him if he didn't go into depressions. And then, of course, he only lived 4 days after the end of the Civil War, which is an extraordinarily sad fact for him and for the country and for history.
Yeah. This is kind of going back to the walks you take in the morning. Something you write about is that you have a specialty of following old people who have trouble walking.
Yes, and I really try to walk like them.
And tell me about that.
I'm co-creating a ballet now with a wonderful choreographer called John Higginbotham. And he's doing the choreography, but a lot of the time I'm very sensitive to the fact that I'm doing this, the visuals, but I'm also in it, which I guess constitutes being an older person in a ballet. And so the way that we move through space is really interesting to me, and I am conscious of the fact that we are moving and dancing in our way all day long. And it's funny because Nietzsche, if I can quote Nietzsche, said that a day that doesn't have dance in it is a lost day, which you wouldn't expect from somebody like Nietzsche. Who was crazy. But at any rate, but also...
and intense.
And intense, and had such a giant mustache, as I write about. But I never, when I saw that quote, I said, this is incomprehensible. But the fact is that we really are all moving and dancing all day long. Mm. And the older you get, the more challenging it is, obviously, and the more dangerous it is. And you can trip. I tripped on the sidewalk and broke my arm. And I thought, well, how did this happen? This is absurd. So my heart goes out to everybody. That's it. My heart goes out to everybody.
You wrote these are beautiful words, I think. And this is from Principles of Uncertainty, I'm pretty sure. How are we all so brave as to take step after step, day after day? How are we so optimistic, so careful not to trip and yet do trip, and then get up and say, okay, why do I feel so sorry for everyone and so proud?
That's a good question. Why?
Yeah. You mentioned aging, and I wanted to ask you about that because it feels to me like you accomplished earlier, or you kind of held on to something that I think we mostly do when we're kids, and then many of us learn to do again as we get older, which is just to slow down, look around, appreciate, challenge the idea that there's any reason to be in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like you kind of held on to that across your lifespan rather than letting it go for the middle years and then coming back to it, relearning it.
And, you know, it's incomprehensible how that happened, but I did, I hear that from people. It's not something that I don't hear, that I somehow have retained the sense of wonder about the world and the sense of beauty and preciousness of our time. So, I mean, sometimes I'm stumbling about not thinking very much. And I have never tried to be that way. That's just, I guess that's how I am.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that also grew out of you, that you were emboldened or equipped to do that because of your mother and somehow the way your childhood worked, or just also, I guess, how you're constituted?
You know, the separating the threads is something that I can't do because you're born a certain way with a certain temperament. Mm-hmm. And then the fates allow this temperament to flourish or not, depending on, you know, on luck.
Yeah.
So I was lucky.
Yeah. But I do feel like it's possible to learn this. And I kind of think your work, your pictures, your books, your writing are little encouragements.
Right, but then I get annoyed at being so encouraging, and I say, wait, I have black moods, too. Like, don't be so encouraged. It's not so good. So I get a little bit contrarian.
It's, you know, I know what you're saying. You don't want to, that sounds kind of cheesy and romantic and optimistic to be encouraging, but it's not, right? It's complex.
Right. It's all, you know, and I shouldn't be embarrassed or ashamed of being, of seeming to be optimistic or encouraging.
That's
because
right.
Really, it's okay. It's all right. I say it's okay. It's fine. Yeah.
That's right. It may be unfashionable, but it may also be necessary.
Yeah. It's okay.
This is kind of an enormous question, but I want to know kind of where you would start walking into it. How your sense of this question of what it means to be human, how your sense of that is evolving now at this point in your life?
Well, I think that, you know, I joke about not knowing, but I think that as people get older, they tend to say more clearly, I really don't know anything. Mm-hmm. And of course, that isn't completely true. But the only thing that I'm left with is really, who do you love? And what do you love to do? So I think that in the end, we're left with this sense of not knowing and striving to find the most true place that you have in this lifetime with people and with work. And I don't know what else there is.
Hmm. And this idea, I mean, these are your words, but that the subject of your work continues to be the normal daily things that people fall in love with. That's very resonant with that. I'm just curious. We're talking in the early afternoon. Have you fallen in love with something today?
Oh, yes.
Tell us.
Too
what
many
have you fallen
things.
In love with? Okay, just start.
Well, I've been painting all day, and And I've been doing paintings for this book about cakes, this cookbook. Mm-hmm. I'm doing paintings and short stories, memories of cake. And there's a page about meringue. And the cookbook author wrote about meringue. And I found this fantastic photograph of an Eastern European bed that has a huge quilt with a huge scalloped edge. And it's all fluffy and white. And it looks just like a meringue. So I'm doing a painting of that bed as the illustration for meringues.
Mm.
So I fall in love with that. And, you know, there was a photograph in the Times today of dancers. And I cut out a lot of photographs of people dancing. And I know I'm going to paint them, too.
Mm.
And I'm sure when I leave here and I walk downtown, I'm going to walk home to 12th Street. There'll be many, many things that will enchant me and make me very happy.
This has been really delightful. I noticed that you said that in your family you don't say goodbye. you say so long. Why is that? Why is that?
I have no idea. I don't know. Because so long sounds a lot sadder than goodbye. So I don't know why. It's something that my mother started.
Okay.
And I'm
your
afraid
mother
to
again.
Change it.
So we began with your mother and we end with your mother.
Everything. It's all connected to her. So Sarah said so long. So that's what I do.
All right. Well, I'm going to say so long to you. And thank you so much. What a pleasure it's been.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me, too. Thank you, Krista.
Myra Kelman is the author and illustrator of over 20 books for adults and children. After she left the studio at the end of this conversation, Myra sent me the following email. You asked what I might fall in love with after our conversation was over. I took off my headphones and walked out of the room and saw these green chairs, which I immediately fell in love with, photographed, and will certainly paint sometime soon. The eternal pleasure of chance encounters. Those chairs belong to our friend Paul Ruest at Argo Studios, and you can check out that photo at instagram.com/onbeing. On Being is
Trent Gilliss, Chris Heagle,
Lily Percy,
Mariah Helgeson,
Maya Tarrell, Marie Sambalay,
Bethany Mann,
and Selena Carlson.
Our lovely theme music is provided and composed by Zoe Keating. And the last voice you hear singing our final credits in each show is hip-hop artist Lizzo. On Being was created at American Public Media. Our funding partners include the Fetzer Institute, helping to build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Find them at fetzer.org. Kalliopeia Foundation, working to create a future where universal spiritual values form the foundation of how we care for our common home. The Henry Luce Foundation, in support of public theology reimagined. The Osprey Foundation, a catalyst for empowered, healthy, and fulfilled lives. And the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interests in religion, community development, and education.
On Being is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and is a Krista Tippett public production.